This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. On tonight's program, Jack Alpert discusses the impact of increased population on our planet with Craig Lubo. But first, I'm Natural E with your headline news. TheEcologist.com reports, the World Trade Organization has found India's huge solar initiative guilty of breaking trade rules because it gives domestic manufacturers a small 10% quota for the supply of panels, leaving up to 90% for foreign competitors. It's a warning for perils of the entire World Trade Organization system and of even harsher trade rules like those in the TPP, TTIP, and CETA. On Wednesday, the 24th of February, it ruled against India's National Solar Mission, which aims to rapidly increase the country's renewable energy and bring energy to millions of people by generating 100 gigawatts of solar energy annually by 2022. The reason? A small portion of the program would have actively supported the creation of local renewable energy jobs. Trade agreements are often stumbling blocks for action on climate change. Current trade rules limit government's capacity to support local renewable energy, undermine clean technology transfer, and empower fossil fuel companies to attack climate protection in secret courts. Trade policies are preventing a sustainable future. In 2012, the World Trade Organization ruled against Ontario's innovative Green Energy Act, which intended to help boost renewable technologies and clean energy jobs. Similar to the Indian case, part of the program included a feed-in tariff that supported local suppliers. The policy was changed to comply with World Trade Organization rules. And in just the last 3 months, Ecuador was ordered to pay $1 billion for canceling a petrol contract under a bilateral investment treaty, and TransCanada announced it would sue the U.S. government and the trade tribunal for $15 billion for rejecting Keystone XL pipeline to transport dirty tar sands. TheGuardian.com reports, climate scientists have bad news for governments, energy companies, motorists, passengers, and citizens everywhere in the world. To contain global warming to the limits agreed by 195 nations in Paris last December, they will have to cut fossil fuel combustion at an even faster rate than anybody had predicted. Dr. Rogel, research scholar at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Austria, and European and Canadian colleagues propose in Nature Climate Change that all previous estimates of the quantities of carbon dioxide that can be released into the atmosphere before the thermometer rises to potentially catastrophic levels are too generous. Instead of a range of permissible emissions estimates that range up to 2,390 billion tons from 2015 onwards, the very most humans could release would be 1,240 billion tons. In effect, that halves the levels of diesel and petrol available for petrol tanks, coal for power stations, and natural gas for central heating and cooking available to humankind before the global average temperature, already 1 degree Celsius higher than it was at the start of the Industrial Revolution, reaches the notional 2 degrees Celsius mark long agreed internationally as being the point of no return for the planet. China's coal consumption fell for the second year in a row, government data showed Monday, as the world's biggest polluter attempts to tackle chronic pollution that accompanied economic growth. Coal use fell 3.7% last year compared to 2014 levels, according to a report from China's National Bureau of Statistics. The drop follows a 2.9% decrease in 2014. Bloomberg.com reports the Sierra Club weighed into the controversy over fracking and increased earthquake risk with a lawsuit accusing a Chesapeake Energy Corporation unit, Devon Energy Production Company, and New Dominion LLC of triggering tremors in Oklahoma and Kansas. The environmental group said the company's practice of injecting liquid oil and gas waste into deep ground wells contributed to a spike of more than 5,800 earthquakes in Oklahoma in 2015, up from an annual high of 167 in the years from 1977 to 2009, according to the complaint filed Tuesday in federal court in Oklahoma City. The lawsuit, which follows more than 20 others since 2011, makes similar allegations, comes after a 5.1 magnitude quake shook the region Saturday. The Sierra Club wants a judge to force the companies to curb the amount of waste being injected into the layers of rock just above the continent's crust in order to reduce the risk of earthquakes. Neither the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency nor the state of Oklahoma has taken legal action to address, quote, the imminent and substantial endangerment to health and the environment, end quote, of the fracking waste practices, according to the complaint. That's all for the news, and I would like to introduce Mr. Craig Lubo to the mic.
Okay, thank you, Naturally. My guest today is Jack Alpert. Jack is the director of Stanford Knowledge Integration Lab, which is a lab he started back in 1978 at Stanford University. The lab has since become an independent nonprofit research foundation since 1992, is no longer associated with Stanford University. His current work is working on discovering and implementing behavior that changes our course and creates a sustainable civilization. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you, Craig.
Okay. Let's start with, in some of the videos I watched of yours, you talk about the impact of the growth that we have and that we are already past the point of sustainability. What is the environmental impacts?
Well, everybody knows the environmental impacts. They're the loss of fish, the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, methane, acid rain, which we somehow managed, fluorine, freon in the atmosphere. But all of those issues are part and parcel of just too many people doing too many things. And the question is, most people are worried about our human footprint getting bigger, and I'm more focused on, have we already grown too large?
Okay. The one of the things you talked about is your energy and fossil fuels in your videos. What you project that we're going to run out completely out of fossil fuels within 100 years.
Within 100 years.
Okay.
The reason there's the numbers, the way you calculate when we're going to run out of fossil fuels is not when the last drop of oil is pumped out of a tank in the bottom of the Earth's crust, but when it becomes more energy intensive to pump it out and process it than we get from the end of this processing process. So that means when we started pumping oil out of the ground, we were getting 100 barrels of energy for every barrel of energy that we put in. This is early in Pennsylvania in the 1900s. And since then, it's dropped to 20, closer to 18 in this last decade. Tar sands, for example, is 4 to 1. It takes a huge amount of energy to get our oil from tar sands. It took very little energy to get our oil from, it was squirting out of the ground in Pennsylvania. So the question is, at what point will it start taking more energy to get it out than we put in to get it? At that point, it's a zero. There's no reason to go get it anymore. And there are people like Charlie Hall at the Earth Science and Forestry School in New York that would say, he had a number called EROI, Energy Return on Energy Invested, and Charlie's pretty much in agreement that this number is falling fast, and even if some of the renewable energy sources approach what we're now getting from petroleum, that together, these renewable resources, plus what we're getting from coal or uranium or oil, we won't be able to support our civilization. In fact, we'll only be able to support a much smaller civilization.
Okay. Now, you talk about renewable sources, and I think I saw that you said that right now we only get about 1% from wind and solar.
Correct.
And you seem to, you didn't have confidence that we can replace a substantial part of those fossil fuels with wind and solar. So what's going on?
Well, right now people are talking about windmills putting out 18 units of energy for every energy unit it took to build the windmill. And that's pretty close to parity with what we're pumping out of the oil wells. But what's not understood is that these windmills are predicated on other energy sources creating the concrete to make the base. They're relying on other energy sources to make the roads and bridges that bring these windmills to their location. They are counting on existing transmission lines. Now, each of these systems, the bridges, the roads, the factories that made the windmills, the company that made the concrete, the trucks that hauled the concrete, they all used fossil fuels to. Now, if the windmill actually had to produce all of the energy that it took to build all those peripheral systems, then the question is, how much energy is left over after they pay their energy bills? Right now, it looks like they can't. I mean, there are some people that say they can, but the numbers that I run suggest windmills and solar panels, they can't produce enough net energy to run human civilization. The way you think about it is, think about solar panels last 30 years. So at the end of 30 years, you've got to put in a new solar panel. Well, that's okay. That's part of the operating costs. And windmills, again, 15 to 30 years. And so these things are great big machines. And the question is, if there were no fossil fuels, if there were no uranium fuels, then all of the energy that came from those windmills and all of the energy that came from those solar panels would have to be used to replace all those parts. Over time, over 100 years or 200 years, every single panel would be replaced, every single bridge would be replaced, every single road would be replaced, and I don't think those machines can make that kind of energy.
Okay, so what do we do then for energy?
Well, we have to be honest. If there really isn't good, I mean, there are hopes that we are going to have fusion reactors. Okay, we're going to figure out how to squeeze two atoms of hydrogen together and end up with an atom of helium and a bunch of excess energy. And we've been trying to do it for a very long time. I mean, my friends at the University of Wisconsin started in 1968. One of them went to work for General Atomic, which is the United States' primary plasma bowl fusion reactor, a tokamak design. They had to increase the containment of the vessel for a duration at a temperature, and they did great work in the 50s and 60s, and they increased that product of those three numbers, temperature, pressure, and heat, until they got it down to a number, and that number had to be crushed three more times. And in the last 40 years, they haven't crushed it at all. They haven't made any progress in making a fusion reactor. Enormous amounts of money went into thorium reactors, liquid salt reactors, which is another. We use breeder reactors and uranium reactors, mostly because they produce plutonium, and plutonium is good for making bombs, but it's not the best source for making electrical power. But all that time that we've been working, and the Canadians worked even long after we gave it up, nobody's developed a liquid fuel reactor that burns thorium, which there's plenty of thorium around. So those are the two big numbers that could come into play. We get fusion, we could have a lot of energy. If we got thorium reactors, we could have a lot of energy. We could make a fully electric society. The environmentalists would say, oh, good, now we can pave over everything. And we can fish out the last fish in the ocean. So there's a danger to having lots of energy, but it doesn't look like we're going to have it.
But if we were to develop fusion, that might take care of some of the energy problems, but we would still have the sustainability problem from agriculture point.
Right. The soil's going to go south. But, you know, the technologists would say if you have enough energy, you can just grow things in water and grow everything hydroponically. You don't need soil. You can just give it up. And in fact, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to have any green space. You don't have it. So the real technologists will say, hey, we can grow whatever we need. Do I believe them? No. And the reason I don't believe them is that the transition to that kind of society, we have to use the coal that we have now, we have to use the oil that we have now just to make those reactors. And it's a race. It's actually a race. Will we have these reactors online delivering energy when the other sources of energy are no longer available?
Okay. Now, as we approach the problem with scarcity, what are the problems in terms of human behavior and environmental issue, environmental justice in particular?
Let's talk about the environmental justice of, you know, the polar bear. Well, certainly, if humans are going to continue to expand and use every piece of soil and burn every pound of coal and put every liter of CO2 in the atmosphere, then the weather's going to change and all bets are off. If we change the weather, we'll be farming in the Arctic Circle, and everything along the equator might be just a cinder. It'd just be dried out. There's nothing there. There's no moisture. If we're going to talk about what people are going to do when we run out of this easy access to energy, there are several people that suggest that we might be down to half by 2050. If we're down to half the energy in 2050, and it takes 9 calories of fossil energy to make 1 calorie of food, then it looks like half the energy means half the food. That's very serious. I mean, sure, we can all be vegetarians and eat lower on the food chain, and we might be able to feed everybody, but there's just as it liable to say, the hamburger people are going to eat the hamburgers, and they get whatever corn is being grown, and 50% of the population in 2050 doesn't eat at all. They're just, you know, they can even farm their own land because the rich people of the world are farming that land because they can buy it and they can pay the cost of getting some water to it. But the dirt farmer, the subsistence farmer, he's basically landless, waterless, and foodless. So what's the implication? The implication is that they'll migrate wherever they can. They will, there'll be a lot of fighting.
We do need to take a break, and when we come back, we are talking with Jack Alpert about sustainability.
This week, it's religion and the Oscars.
There was a moment when we were researching the story, the four members of the Spotlight team, when we realized we had all been raised Catholic. At that time, I would say we were all lapsed Catholic.
We peek behind the curtain at the religious themes that gave rise to two Oscar-nominated movies, Spotlight and Son of Saul. I'm Maureen Fiedler. That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right before The Jazz Disciple.
Tips for preventing contaminated stormwater runoff. On this current cast. Rainwater is naturally filtered as it soaks into the ground. But in cities, rain lands on impermeable streets and rooftops.
And as the stormwater flows over these areas, it picks up things like trash and chemicals, sand and grit, bacteria, other pollutants, and then it flows into our local rivers, streams, lakes, and oceans, often without treatment to remove these sorts of pollutants.
That's Rachel Herbert of the EPA's Office of Wastewater Management. She says no matter how far you live from the water, avoid littering. Check your car for leaks, pick up pet waste, and properly dispose of paint, chemicals, and used motor oil. This will help protect both local and distant water resources. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Okay, we're back with Jack Alpert, and this is Craig Lubo. We're talking about sustainability, and we are going to open up the lines for phone calls if you have any questions or comments. The number is 816-931-5534. Again, that's 816-931-5534. Okay. Jack, in a lot of your writings, you talk about how much degrowth is necessary. And what you talk about is that to save civilization, we have to shrink the population. Okay. Tell us the end number, and then we can talk about how you got to it. What do we need to shrink to?
My background was engineering, and so I actually am a plumber. And I talk about where am I going to get the energy, and what am I going to do with each joule of energy? How do I grow the food? How do I create transportation? Is this civilization going to have a symphony? How many years of education per person? When do people retire? How many square feet per person? What's the transportation system? And so I got a group of my friends together, and we talked about the Earth's sustainable population. Not to drop names, but they were heavy hitters. William Catton, who wrote Overshoot, David Pimentel from Cornell, who's the food person. We had a transmission line person, soils person from University of Oregon, and another from Washington. We got together and we just tried to ballpark it, you know, where's the land that we're going to grow the food? Where is the city? Where are the power lines coming in? Is there going to be any, are we going to have any petroleum and fossil energy at all? Will we have any uranium energy? Will we have any solar? Will we have any wind? And all of those answers were no. What we decided in that group was that we would take the existing hydroelectric system of the United States and Canada and pool it together, the Colorado dams, the Columbia River dams, and we figured out that we could support 6 million people with symphony-like 25 years of education per person, healthcare. 6 million people was what we could support in all of North America. And they were all going to live in the Pacific Northwest. And then somebody came up with the idea that we could take Quebec Hydro and run a big transmission line across the United States. And with that, we got closer to 10 million people. That's 96,000 kilowatt hours. So that group did that initial study, and that means 10 million people in all of North America. That's 33 million Canadians and 300 million Americans and 144 million Latin Americans, and all of that community would have to condense down to 10 million. Since then, we've done a little bit of work to find out that we can support 25 million people in China and another 13 million people in Uruguay, Brazil area on their height. These are all hydroelectric societies. Every joule of energy comes into the society from the hydroelectric system and is very closely maintained. That means no one lives anywhere in the United States. There are no cars. There are no airplanes. We didn't have energy to move things from Shanghai to Portland. Each of these three communities live by itself. We didn't have enough energy to have anybody living in Europe. We didn't have enough energy to have anybody living in Russia or Africa or Australia or India or all of Oceania. So that's where the number came from. 50 million people is an engineer's view of how many people can live on the planet. And this was done, the same calculations were done for the space station. They figured out that they could support three guys up there. And after a while, after they made it bigger, they could support six. But it was perfectly obvious that they couldn't support 20. There wasn't room for their gear. There wasn't room for the people. There wasn't a way to handle the water reclamation. So We did the same thing for Earth, and we came up with a number of 50 million.
Okay. And when you talk about that, again, that's for the whole planet.
For the whole planet.
Not just our country.
Exactly. Okay. 10 million for all of North America. No one in Europe. Can you imagine? No one in Europe. We started adding up the hydroelectric capacities of Finland and Sweden, and they didn't have enough to have critical mass. You actually, if you're going to have a symphony, if you're going to have universities, if you're going to have high-tech development, that's about the smallest community you can build that will have all of those services is about 10 million. And that means nobody's wasted.
For those who want to know what hydroelectric is, that's based on water.
Right. These are rivers that are dammed up already. And in fact, when we did the calculations, we could not rebuild Hoover Dam. We could not rebuild the Columbia River dams. We couldn't keep them from silting up either. So that even this hydroelectric solution only gives you a 300-year breathing room. At the end of 300 years, you will have what's known as river run, which means you have water generated in spring and no water generated in fall.
When's the last time the planet has been down to 50 million?
That's a good question. I'm guessing there were 300 million people here at the time of Christ. So it could have been, 2,000 or 3,000 years, 2,000 years before Christ, B.C. Right.
So what would you say? I'm guessing some people might say, okay, 2,000 years ago.
They weren't stable. That wasn't a sustainable society. They were busting out all over. They wouldn't have left Africa.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about designing a sustainable society, and we've never had one. Bacteria in a petri dish have never been stable. They just keep growing until they bump into things, and they do bad things to each other. I mean, that's how we make wine.
And humans act the same way as the bacteria.
Right. And my field is cognitive science. The question is, can you build a human being that's smart enough to not look like a yeast?
All right. And the fusion that we talked about before.
Yes.
If we were to develop that, what would that do to your estimate as to what level we could sustain?
Okay. If we got fusion online and it started producing enough energy to not only support itself, but to support everything else, then we could pave over the world. We might even be able to escape the world. I mean, infinite energy is infinite energy. Okay. So it wouldn't look anything like the things that you and I live with. I mean, we're not talking about grass. I think it was Paul Ehrlich in his book, Population Bomb, in the very beginning said, what's the maximum population of Earth? And the way he did it was he said, black body radiation is the temperature that a body radiates into outer space, and then the energy from outer space coming in is the same rate, so it doesn't get hotter. So the maximum temperature was this titanium skin. They built it all the way around the Earth so that it was like a globe outside, and it was 300 stories high, and then he calculated the number of apartments that would be in 300 stories if the whole world was covered in a 300-story building, all the water area, and that's sort of the max. It's the temperature of black body radiation, getting rid of the heat.
Okay. I want to give out the number again for those who might have questions or comments, and it's 816-931-5534.
Did I answer your question? I can't remember what Paul said, but, it was in trillions. What was interesting about what Paul said was that in your lifetime, you could go 40 stories up and down the elevator chute, and you could go so many, a kilometer or something, in any direction. And it turns out that would be like the whole civilization that's on Earth. I mean, it was like that would be the 7.5 billion people in this little column. And there would be 7,000, beetles, because there would be 7,000 columns of that kind of nature.
All right. So let's say So we need to get down to 50 million.
Somewhere in there.
Okay.
Depending upon the science, could be a little more or a little less.
All right. And how do you do that?
Well, you should ask. You can figure it out. You can do the math with me. Ask yourself how many people who are alive today, okay, February 29th, 2016, how many of us who are living today would be dead in 2100, 80, 85, 84 years from now, of the 7.2 billion? And the answer is almost all of them. Okay, we can die of old age. I mean, no disease, no conflict, no violence. We just all die of old age. And so the entire 7.2 billion people are going to die between now and 2100. Okay, so the question is, how many people are going to live in 2100? Well, if there's going to be 50 million people in 2100, let's assume that the average age is 100. I mean, that's how long people live. So that means that there are going to be 100 cohorts, 100 years, and every year we're going to have 500,000 people be born. Okay, so and at the end of that pipe, 500,000 people are going to die every year. So we got half a million being born, 500,000, 500,000 dying at the end of 100 years. And then in between, you got 100 groups of 500,000, that's 50 million. So all you got to do is make sure that 500,000 people are born every year, and you got it.
Okay, so that means a lot less than even one child per family.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't mean one child per family, but it doesn't mean bad things about the number of children per woman either. In the beginning, if we only gave out 500,000 birth permits, it's one permit per 140 women. That's pretty harsh. Okay, only one in every 140 women is going to have a child. Okay, so that's where you start. But as the population drops, because you lose 100 million people a year from death, you get down to 50 million people. And you don't even have to get all the way to 50 million. You just have to get down to the fraction of women that are going to be fertile from 0 to 50, because the ones between 50 and 100 are going to be infertile. They're not going to be abused anymore. Okay, so think about this. Let's give out 500,000 birth permits to a population of 50 million. This is the end condition. Okay, that's enough for 2 permits per woman. Okay, but a third of the women by choice or health won't have any children. So their 2 permits are up for grabs. Okay, a third of the women will have 1 child by choice or health. So 3 permits are up for grabs. But that means that the third group of women have to have an average of 5 children. Those 3 plus their 2 is 5. Okay, and any woman who doesn't want to have 5 children, let's assume they want to have 4, another woman has to have 6. And every woman that wants 3, some woman has to have 7. And every woman that wants just 2 kids, some woman has to have 8. So if you had a stable population in a community that wasn't growing, almost every woman could have whatever number of children she wanted. And in fact, when I did the calculations, when you run the numbers a little finer grain, you realize that you might not get all of the 500,000 birth permits used. And that's a very serious problem for a society that's only 50 million on the face of the earth, because the person who doesn't get born might be the first chair violinist in your symphony. You need every one of those people. You need every one of those permits to get used. And so the society might have to be enticing women or families to have children so that all the permits get used. Because if they don't get used, the society diminishes. So while this birth lottery to have children, while in the beginning, in the transition, because it took us, 5,000 years to get into the trouble that we are with too many people, going forward, we got to fix it in 85 years. So it's a big trauma. There are a lot of people going to be injured. But actually, when we get to a sustainable society, at least birth-wise, no women will be injured. No families will be limited from having children. In fact, we're going to want everyone, and there might be 2 years of paid leave so that you can have a baby. And that's the the gift that society gives anybody who's willing to have one.
Now, you talked about you're assuming that within a period of time that the average lifespan is going to be 100 years. Isn't that being, like, extremely optimistic?
Oh, yeah.
Taking into account famine, conflict?
Oh, no. These are injuries.
I've seen some studies with people predicting that half of the population is going to disappear because of disease.
Right. And that could happen. I mean, I'm not saying that's out, but it wouldn't change the number of births. Okay? If we had a black plague and we lost a third of the population, we'd still be giving out 500,000 birth permits. If we incinerated each other, but didn't destroy all food growing capacities, we'd still be giving out 500,000 birth permits a year. Violence is nasty. The question is whether or not, with planning, and the planning is really pretty interesting, with planning you can get the population to go down. You have to understand that if you only have 500,000 birth permits a year, that within 3 or 4 years there's going to be no preschools. They're wanting no diapers, no baby food. Within 8 years there will be no public schools. In 3 more years, no middle schools. In 12 years, no high schools. And, okay, there'll still be universities because people will continue to study for much longer periods of time, and they'll retread. But the idea is that, on one hand, what happened to all those preschool teachers? Well, that's the 100 million people that are dying of old age on that end. They're people who are retiring and leaving the workforce. They come from the bottom services.
Now, you mentioned that if we, going back a little bit to the food issue.
Okay.
If we solve the energy problem and we have unlimited energy, we can feed everybody.
Right.
Doesn't that, though, well, you said growing stuff in the water. But
there is.
Aren't you limited to, seems to me that a lot of the food would come from GMOs.
Absolutely.
And I mean, absolutely. So if we don't want GMOs, then
we may have to have GMOs no matter what. We may have. I mean, you have to realize that in 2050, if we suddenly stop feeding half the world's population, they're going to be cannibals. The ones that can't come to your cupboard are going to be cannibals.
All right.
The future is incredibly unpleasant. And so any decisions that we make have to be made by a large group of people, billions of people in the world, have to say the future is so unpleasant that I actually will consider a birth lottery as being less painful, and that the outcome is better than just playing it by ear and letting everything, let the chips fall when they may.
So let me give out the number once more. Phone number, if you have any questions, is 816-931-5534, and I think we have a break coming up right now, too.
Advanced medical technologies can be exorbitantly costly. However, it's not human inventiveness and inventions in medical science that are responsible for U.S. per capita healthcare expenditures that are double and triple those of other advanced nations. We'll hear all about medical technology and the costs of healthcare in the United States from Professor David Kingsley this Wednesday at 6 p.m. on the All Souls Forum, right here on KKFI.
Khadija, I heard about this radio show. It's about race.
What? A show about race?
Yeah, on the radio. It's on the community radio station, KKFI.
You're supposed to talk about that around your kitchen table.
Yeah, and that's what I thought, but it's actually on the radio talking about race and racial things.
What time is it?
It's 7 o'clock Thursday.
And what's the name of this show?
Khadija and the White Guy.
Say what?
Yeah, Keith Washburn and...
Khadija Hardaway.
See you then, Thursday night at 7 o'clock.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Bill Nye is on a mission to change the world, and two filmmakers are on a mission to document it.
In 2015, Jason Susberg and David Alvarado launched a Kickstarter campaign to follow the iconic educator, also known as The Science Guy, whose hit show in the 90s inspired many millennials' interest in science, including Susberg's.
He had a way of communicating science that just made it hip and cool.
The Kickstarter campaign raised more than $800,000 and became the most widely supported documentary in Kickstarter history, with nearly 17,000 donors.
Everybody seemed to have spoken that people want to see a film about Bill Nye and his mission to change the world.
The film goes behind the scenes with Nye as he sets out to raise climate change awareness. To reach everyone, from those convinced to those still unconvinced about climate change, Nye is writing a new book and participating in televised discussions. Drawing on his unique personality and trademark humor, he's also spreading awareness at rallies, on the news, and on social media.
Rather than sitting on his laurels, he's turning his attention to what he sees to be humanity's biggest challenge.
The film is slated for release in early 2017. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, we're back with Jack Alpert, and we're talking about sustainability, and we do have a caller on the phone. Can we have your first name and where you're calling from?
Ariana and Independence.
Okay, and what's your question?
I hope this isn't redundant. I just got in on the program a few minutes ago. In order to be able to pull this off, there's going to have to be a lot of consent and a lot more unanimous action than what we're currently capable of, it seems. So how does the author propose that we get there, and what type of structure would the governance need to take to get there?
Okay.
Thank you for your question.
Ariana,
thank
it's,
you.
It's a really good question, and I've been working on it for about 40 years, and for a long time I thought that I could raise the cognitive abilities of infants. In fact, I started thinking about raising the cognitive abilities of college students, but I was driven down to the bare nuts and bolts of a child between 6 days and 6 months old. And so one route is actually using some of those tools that I invented 20 years ago to raise the cognitive abilities of 6-day-old infants. But I've also realized that that's not going to be fast enough. So I have started a project called Change the Course. And if you say change the course to Google, you'll probably find it. If you don't, you can go to my website, which is skil.org, and you can find Change the Course. But Change the Course essentially says, design the society, demonstrate that it'll work, show what's going to happen to our society on its present course. Okay. Now, once you write the rules of how this new society works, you have to get 3 million people to vote for this new social contract. You know, social contract is essentially how did we get abolition or suffrage into our social contract?
Right.
All right. So I'm going to write a social contract, and then I'm going to try and get 3.5 billion people to vote for it. Bottom up, I'm not counting on the Pope. I'm not counting on the federal government. I'm not counting on the green movement. I'm really counting on the ability of two grandmothers over the back fence. One grandmother says, I'm going to vote for this social contract. It really sounds terrible. And when I say terrible, it means if one grandmother says, I want to get rid of slavery, and the other grandmother had a slave plantation, the second grandmother would say, if I give up my slaves, I'm losing everything. And the first grandmother says, yeah. Now, I'm going to convince you anyway. The question is, if we can put the pieces together so that the second grandmother comes over and says, yes, I'll vote for the contract, then we have a path to 3 billion people. You know how long it takes to get 3 billion people? If it takes the grandmother a month, and at the end of the month, the second grandmother will participate in getting another grandmother?
Not very long if you're super successful.
Well, No. It we'll just do the math. Let's assume that the grandmother can be successful with just one single person a month.
All right.
Two grandmothers get two, and four grandmothers get four, and eight grandmothers get eight, and so on.
All right.
How long does it take? How many months does it take to get 3.5 billion people? This is the old rice on the checkerboard problem, but it's 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 1,000. So it takes 10 cycles, 10 months to get the first 1,000 people, but it only takes another 10 months to get three more zeros, a million, okay? And more zeros, 32 months. So we're not talking about a really long time, but we're counting on having the grandmothers or whoever they are, the two peer people talking to each other that have been friends for a long time, once figured out that it's okay to give up some of our freedoms to get a system that works, they can get the 3.5 billion people together in 32 months. So that's my plan. I have no faith at all in the Sierra Club or in any of the environmental movements or in the managing carbon dioxide people or eating green or lower on the food chain or veganism or I don't think it's a moral issue. I think people have to be able to give value to their grandchildren. If they can see that their grandchildren and their children and even themselves are going to be in very deep trouble, that ought to be motivation enough to say, he's not asking me to change my behavior. He's only asking me to vote. And in fact, that's what happened in abolition. The North, the highly populated North, voted. They didn't give up slaves. They just voted that we couldn't have slavery. And it was the Southern, smaller population that had to accept it. Now, they're sure there was this terrible war, but the fact is the top management system, the government for the United States, moved by being pushed by the people at the bottom. Suffrage was done the same way.
Right.
So that's my model for change.
And then it's like a cycle where after the government is pushed, then the government has to then push the others who have not come along.
Right. The people at the end, the last 3 billion people on the face of the earth who don't want to have a birth lottery as the mechanism for allowing children, they get drug along like the slave owners.
To convince them, though, you're going to have to convince them that a birth lottery is going to be fair and it's not going to favor just the rich and powerful.
Right. It's got to be completely random. 7.2 people are in the lottery. Any of them can get a ticket, a winning ticket, and there's 500,000 winning tickets a year. And what they do with that ticket, they can sell it if they want. They can give it to their granddaughter if they're, you know, if a grandfather wins the ticket. He can do whatever he wants with it. But it's got to be completely fair. The only people who are left out of the lottery are the ones that are unborn or dead. If you're alive, you're in the lottery. Does that help?
I'm 26, and I'm not intending to add to the problem by reproducing. So let's hope that we can be successful. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Okay. We just have about a minute and a half left. Let me ask you, there's a phrase you use in your video, which is that overpopulation means that we are murdering people, that every one of us is doing that.
How's that possible? Well, it turns out that I drive my car to McDonald's and buy a burger. And the question is, did that tighten the amount of fuel that was available to grow food for somebody else, somewhere else in the world? I mean, it's all one system. It's all one grain harvest. It just gets moved around. And so by driving my car, I took fuel out of the fertilizer pot, and I took fuel out of the transportation pot, and I took fuel out of the irrigation pot. And so I can't do anything in my life without murdering somebody because the system is so full and there are so many people. There's a billion people living on a dollar a day.
All right. We need to wrap this up. I want to thank you. For those just joining us, we've been talking to Jack Alpert, and we've been talking about sustainability and population. And next up is the calendar.
This is Naturally, and I have your calendar of events. March 1st, tomorrow at 6 p.m., hosted by the Kansas City Community Gardens, the Planning Your Plot for Garden Success workshop will share how to create a planning plan to help maximize garden space, get more vegetables, and save time and money. KCCG has developed some new tools to help you create a garden plan and shopping list for spring, summer, and fall. This free event will be held 6 p.m. on Tuesday, March 1st, at the Rosedale Development Association, which is located at 1403 Southwest Boulevard in Kansas City, Kansas. Workshops are free, but space is limited, so please RSVP by calling 816-931-3877, or you can find the link to do so on our Eco Radio Facebook page. On March 4th at 12 p.m., hosted again by the Kansas City Community Gardens, you can go to a workshop called Selecting, Planting, and Caring for Berry Plants, and you'll learn how to grow berries in your backyard. Learn about the different varieties of fruit-bearing shrubs and how to care for them to produce healthy, high-yielding plants. This workshop will focus on strawberries, blackberries, and raspberries, but we'll discuss other fruit plants as well. This free event will be held at 12 noon on Friday, March 4th at 6917 Kensington. And again, the workshop is free, but space is limited, so RSVP by calling 931-3877 with the 816 area code. Or you could also go to our Eco Radio KC Facebook page and find the link. And our last event for you is March 5th from 9 a.m. to 12 noon. You can join Cultivate Kansas City on their Work the Farm days. This year, Cultivate KC is offering volunteer opportunities at Gibbs Road Farm every second Saturday and the Juniper Gardens Training Farm every first Saturday. Volunteers should wear weather-appropriate clothing, closed-toe shoes that can get dirty, and bring a water bottle. Gloves and tools will be provided. In case of rain or inclement weather, please check your email to make sure the workday is happening. Again, this is from 9 a.m. to noon on Saturday, March 12th at the Juniper Gardens in Kansas City, Kansas. And you can sign up for this Work the Farm event by visiting Eco Radio KC on Facebook.
It's Oscar time, but not the ones you're thinking of. That and other stories for the week ending February 28th, 2016.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Once again, there is breaking news that pregnant women and children in an American community have been told to stop drinking tap water contaminated with lead. This time, it's in Jackson, Mississippi. Last June, water samples from almost 60 homes randomly chosen in Jackson showed that the tap water had lead levels higher than acceptable amounts.
Even so, it wasn't until 6 months later that state officials told city leaders of the testing results.
Then in early February, the EPA said that it had tested the same households and found that only two of the original test sites had unsafe lead levels.
Despite these results, last week state officials warned that pregnant women and children 5 years old and younger should stay away from tap water because of lead.
And they urged that children under 6 years old should be screened for lead in their blood.
Last Thursday, some residents of Jackson waited in line to get 2 gallons of free bottled water from the Salvation Army, and one woman expressed her worry to the Clarion Ledger, saying she's not trustful, adding that the water's brown in South Jackson and pleading for something to be done.
Swaziland is a small, landlocked country in southern Africa that has been suffering a severe drought recently. Nearly 300,000 people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance, according to the UN.
Beside the human crisis, animals are also in danger. Among them are 18 elephants, and several zoos in the U.S. are planning to airlift them so they would not be slaughtered or culled.
Besides saving the elephants, moving them may relieve pressure on other animals such as rhinos.
A spokesperson for the World Wildlife Federation told The Guardian that there's nothing left for the wild animals to eat in some places.
But another animal safety group, Friends of Animals, has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has granted authority for the transfer.
The organization claims that the trauma of taking elephants from their families and forcing them to live in captivity will have permanent detrimental effects.
In the meantime, predators like lions are taking advantage of prey that have been weakened by the lack of food and water.
Virtually all forests in the U.S. are now vulnerable to decline as the climate changes more rapidly than trees can adapt. This is the conclusion of a report released last week by scientists from 14 different research facilities.
The effects of climate change and drought on forests have been seen more in the U.S. West, but now there is concern about what might happen to entire species of trees, particularly in the East.
Billions of trees in western states have died due to problems such as bark beetles, wildfires, and lack of water.
But the lead author of the study, James Clark of Duke University, said that forests in the East may also be at risk.
Clark said that forestry scientists have a pretty good idea of how individual trees react to drought and climate change, but there's some uncertainty about what might happen at a species-wide level.
According to the study, it is still going to be difficult to anticipate the types of forests that will be here in 20 to 40 years.
2015 was the hottest year on record. Snow fell in Saudi Arabia in January, there was extreme flooding in the UK, and temperatures at the North Pole were warmer than parts of California. So how does that make you feel?
According to a growing number of psychologists, extreme events like these are taking a toll on our mental health, whether we experience them firsthand or just worry about them.
A 2012 report from the National Wildlife Federation predicted cases of anxiety, substance abuse, suicides, and violence will rise sharply as heat waves, floods, and drought put pressure on clean water, food prices, and infrastructure.
The American Psychological Association says that children, the poor, and the elderly will be hardest hit because they are more likely to live in low-income housing, and rising food prices will put pressure on poor households.
One of the groups hardest hit are farmers, as volatile weather weakens crops, making them more vulnerable to weeds, insects, and disease.
In some small farming communities in California, where wells have dried up, there's been a rise in calls to local crisis hotlines.
Carla Sawyer, a public health nurse for Tulare County, said she's counseled several families after loved ones resorted to suicide and left notes about wells going dry or losing jobs as farm workers.
And for those not yet directly affected, there is a deep sense of anxiety and loss, leaving one feeling hopeless, powerless, and paralyzed.
According to researchers, the path forward is the burgeoning field of environmental psychology. The goal is to acknowledge people's emotional responses to climate change and then present tangible solutions to reduce anxiety and empower people to take action. And finally this week, the Oscars were being handed out, but these ones were not for Best Supporting Actress or Best Director.
While you might have been watching the red carpet in L.A., over in West Virginia, YouTube was live streaming the 26th annual Berkeley Springs International Water Tasting, the self-proclaimed Oscars of Water.
Over 100 entrants, both corporate and municipal, from around the globe, competed for titles like Best Tap Water, Best Purified Drinking Water, and Best Bottled Sparkling Water.
While there may not have been live commentary on designer gowns, bottled water companies did dress up their labels specifically for the competition.
The Berkeley contest, the longest running and most prestigious water tasting competition in the world, is also educational, with speakers covering a range of topics from protecting water quality, green stormwater practices, to water security in a changing world.
Okay, so we know we have you on the edge of your seats, waiting to hear who won. So Franny, take the envelope, please, and tell us who was the big winner.
In the category Best U.S. Tap Water, the winner is El Dorado Springs, Colorado.
While the Oscars in L.A. have been criticized for a lack of diversity, the Water Oscars had entrants from many cultures around the world, and generally, water is colorless, so the awards were based on nothing else but good taste.
This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn more at awwa.org/sustainable16.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC. On 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.